What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Eyewitness History. I am, of course, your host, Josh Cohen. Well, this episode, I have the pleasure, once again, to be slightly self-indulgent, indulge my deep love and passion for boxing. And this episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Steve Farhood. So Steve Farhood has been around the Sweet Science for 34 years, most of which have been spent as editor-in-chief of The Ring and KO magazines. Farhood works as an on-air analyst for Showtime's Showbox series, Showtime Championship Boxing, and the syndicated Broadway Boxing series. He also writes a column and features for Boxing Monthly, for which he also serves as an associate editor. Here we discuss his eyewitness history to a number of events, such as the infamous Tyson-Holyfield fight, where Tyson bit off Holyfield's ear, the No Mas fight involving Roberto Duran and Sugar Ray Leonard in their infamous rematch. We also discuss his relationship with the great Muhammad Ali, among many other things. It was such a pleasure, and I think you'll enjoy it as well. And now I give you Steve Farhood. Okay, I'm here with Steve Farhood. Steve, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me, Joshua.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you. So listeners of the show will undoubtedly know the special place that boxing has in my heart. I know, you know, I interviewed your friend Barry Tompkins a few weeks ago. We were talking a little bit before we went on air here that I'm a state boxing champion myself, which I don't say to brag, but it's just something I'm very proud of. So lots I want to get to, Steve, but before we get there, please tell our listeners briefly sort of who you are and what you do.
Well, I'm 65 years old and I started in boxing at the age of 21. When I graduated college with a degree in journalism, I tried to get a job on newspaper. Applied to about 150 newspapers, got 150 rejections, which was kind of standard. I ended up getting a job with a publishing company that put out boxing and wrestling magazines, London Publishing in Long Island. And I was I would call it a casual boxing fan up to that point. I mean, in the 70s, everything in America was Ali. There really were no other American boxers,
right,
of note. It was all Ali. So I would go to the Ali, major Ali fights, you know, at the Garden where they drop the big screen down and you watch it on closed circuit. But I wasn't, outside of Ali and Duran, I really wasn't that much of a boxing fan. But I became one very quickly when I got the job as a writer-editor at the London Publishing. And from 78 till about 90, 91, I was primarily print journalism, and which included in the beginning writing professional wrestling stories, which was an interesting part of my career. And then Showbox started in 2001 with Showtime. And I've been part of that broadcast for 21 years and doing much more television in addition to the writing. So boxing has been pretty much all I've done. Nobody wants to hear anything else from me about anything else. Nobody gives me a chance to talk about anything else. So it's boxing, 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 and have never been bored. It's a fascinating sport. It's a fascinating business, and I still love it.
Excellent. Can't beat that. So did you always know that your place in the boxing ecosystem, let's say, was going to be in journalism, or did you ever have aspirations to box yourself?
No, I tried boxing. I was a weekend athlete, fairly athletic in my day. That day has come and gone. But in my early 20s, I tried boxing just to experience it a little bit and realized very quickly that it's very easy to hit someone and it's very difficult to be hit by someone. So I did it just enough to know that, you know, it's a little lot safer to write about it. But no, I always knew it would always be journalism. That's what I always wanted to do. That's what I loved. And boxing gave me, I mean, the sport is so fascinating. It gave me a wide, you know, I just learned and learned and learned, and it gave me a wide path to go. And one of the things that kept me going all these years, 40 something years, is that, you know, subtle changes in my responsibilities, job description, and that's kept it fresh.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm curious what your most memorable, well, actually, what I love to ask is what your favorite Muhammad Ali fight was, since you brought it up.
Well, I was fortunate enough, and I don't think there are too many other current boxing journalists who can say this, I was fortunate enough to cover his last two fights live, including the fight in the Bahamas against Trevor Burbick, which was a very strange experience. And I was in my early 20s, and I was surrounded by all these veteran journalists, mostly print journalists, who had followed Ali around the world and knew him well, and he loved the press, and the press loved him. So I felt very out of place. But looking back now, all these years later, what an experience to have covered Muhammad Ali's last two fights. So, you know, that's one of the first memories I have of big time boxing. And being spending a little bit of time with Ali is, of course, something that I cherish very, very, very much.
Absolutely. Yeah, the drama in the Bahama. People seem to forget that fight. Everyone always seems to think his last fight was with Larry Holmes. And it should have been, of course, in my opinion. But yeah, so can you recall what your last meeting with Muhammad Ali was like? I think our listeners would love to know what he's like behind closed doors.
Well, I'll tell you two very quick stories. One is when Tom Hauser was doing his work with Ali, he brought Ali to a grammar school in Harlem. And needless to say, these kids were all 5, 7, 8, 10 years old. They didn't know anything about Muhammad Ali. I attended, as some other writers did, and it was amazing to see the magnetism. I mean, this was the Pied Piper. These kids fell for him immediately without knowing how great he was as a fighter. Of course, his greatness goes a lot further than his boxing. But just seeing his effect on people, on kids that didn't know who he was, you know, for someone my age to be in awe of Ali is one thing. But these kids didn't know who he was, and it was fascinating to see. Sadly, the last time I saw him or spent any time with him, it was the time of the Ring 75th anniversary, the Ring Magazine 75th anniversary celebration, and he agreed to tape something for the big gala we were having in Atlantic City. So I went with a camera guy and a sound guy, and he did his shtick, but this was well into his Parkinson's. He did his shtick, and then the PR person who was there said, do you want to spend a little time alone with him in his bedroom just to interview him? And I said, well, of course, what am I going to say? No.
Right.
He couldn't do it, really. He just couldn't do it. He's uncommunicative, and it was very difficult, and I felt very awkward. I mean, he was the most vibrant man that I had ever met, and obviously this disease had, you know, compromised him considerably. And so I spent about 5 minutes with him in the room, and it was awkward. And then I just, you know, I excused myself as politely as I could, and that was the end of it. And the irony of it all is that we know that Ali was probably greatly affected by the punishment he took in the ring, but he did contract Parkinson's, and that's the disease I have now. So,
Yes, sir.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic. But it was great to spend time with him, and even at the end, I mean, he was still Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I have to admit, I'm somewhat jealous. I wish I could have met him.
Yeah, he was like no one else. I mean, he really was. I also went once to his training grounds in Deer Lake, Pennsylvania, with him on a bus with a bunch of other writers, and seeing him at Deer Lake, which was his second home, and he loved it so much, years after he retired, was also a thrill.
Yeah, excellent. So, no, thank you, Steve. Moving on a little bit, I'm kind of curious. I asked Barry Tompkins this a few weeks ago. I'm kind of curious with announcers, sportscasters, and the like about nerves. Did you ever get nervous when you went in front of a camera to call a fight?
Well, that's a very good question. There are two types of people on television. One is they're hams and they're natural performers. And I mean, I've worked a lot with Barry, as you know. I've worked a lot with Al Bernstein, as you know.
The great Al Bernstein.
I've never seen any nerves from either one of them at all. Me, I'm not a ham. I'm not an actor. I'm not, in the beginning especially, I wasn't comfortable. You know, look, I'm a Lebanese American with a big nose and a receding hairline and a Brooklyn accent. So if I could get on TV, anybody could get on TV. But the first Showbox we ever did, and I had done a lot of TV before that, but the very first Showbox, July 2001, as we were going on live, 15 seconds, 10 seconds, 5 seconds, my heart was beating so fast that I was actually worried that you could hear it on the microphone.
Really?
And then, you know, I was working next to Nick Charles, who was a dear friend and a real pro, and that made it much easier. And once the show started, boom. So do you get nervous before shows? Yes, I get nervous before shows. Once the show starts, no problem.
That's fascinating because I have to tell you, that experience is very similar to me when I was boxing. A bundle of nerves right up until the opening bell. Bell rings, game time, go. And it all just dissipates.
First time you land a punch or get hit, you're in it.
You're in it.
And you're good.
Yeah.
It's the same with it. I think it's similar to television. You know, once you start, you're in it and you're good.
Interesting. Yes, the great Nick Charles, who's sadly no longer with us. I believe he passed from cancer.
Yes.
Yes, sir. So June 28th, 1997, Mike Tyson bites Evander Holyfield's ear in the third round of their heavyweight rematch. Yes. Yeah. The attack, it led to his disqualification from the match, and certainly one of the more infamous, the thing that casual or non-boxing fans will know about the sport, right? I know you were there that night, and I'd love for you to be able to describe what the experience was like, and if you knew right away what was happening, or did it all seem kind of ethereal?
Well, the actual moment that it happened, I'll compare it to Duran Leonard Nomas in New Orleans, which I also was covering. When that happened, every writer in press row turned to the guy next to him and said, "What happened? Like, did I just see that?" You know, clearly the fight was over, but the idea of Duran quitting was so unimaginable that we weren't sure what we had just seen had happened. For me, anyway, it was very different with Tyson and Holyfield, the rematch. As soon as it happened, I knew exactly what had happened. I had seen it, and I knew he bit him in the ear. I could tell by what Holyfield, how Holyfield reacted and what Tyson had done.
Sure.
And then, of course, it was mass hysteria. I'm glad the fight was in Vegas because, you know, Vegas's boxing crowds tend to be, they want to be there, especially in the good seats. They want to be there to be seen. So I didn't think there would be a riot. And fortunately, it wasn't a riot. But upstairs in the casino was a little different story. Huh. And about an hour after the fight was over, Nigel Collins and I, he was my colleague at the time, great guy. Nigel and I went up to the lobby of the MGM in Vegas. And I will never forget the scene. It looked like a Civil War battlefield. There were people strewn flat on the ground in the lobby. And I went up to a security guard and I said, "Are they dead?" And he said, "No, they're not dead. They were trampled." I will never forget that.
Wow.
I think that what happened in the casino, where they overturned tables and they grabbed chips and that, you know, there was basically a riot in the casino, that I think got underreported. You know, but it was crazy. It was absolutely crazy. All these bodies just, you know, because of what was going on, there was a gunshot in the casino and everybody fled. So actually the scene in the casino was a lot more crazy than the scene ringside.
Holy Toledo.
Yeah, it was something.
I didn't know any of that.
But you're not a real boxing writer unless you're involved in a couple of, you know, riots.
Of scuffles. Yeah. No, that's true. You got me thinking of Bo Galata. If our listeners want to be reminded of a riot.
That was the mama of all riots.
Truly.
What happened there very quickly was I was there.
Yes.
And my wife was, it was, you know, probably 11:30 or so when that happened. And my wife was asleep. And she gets a phone call. This is a minute, 2 minutes after the riot begins, from the BBC in England. Now, keep in mind, it's about 5 a.m. in England. And she has no idea what's going on. And they say, "There's a riot at the garden. Is your husband there?" She says, "No, he's at the garden." So she turns on HBO and gives the BBC radio a live report off TV of what's going on. Meanwhile, she's petrified that I'm somehow damaged or hurt. Fortunately, I wasn't. But it was pretty funny because, you know, she was asleep, had no idea what was going on. And now she's playing reporter for the BBC. So that was pretty funny.
Yeah, that's amazing. That is funny. Maybe just a quick word for our non-boxing fans, just to give some context. The Bo Galata fight, a riot was caused because Andrew Galata kept doing low blows against Riddick Bowe, which was extraordinary to me because if memory serves me, I think Galata was ahead on during that fight.
Yeah.
He was like well ahead, I think.
Yeah.
So the whole scene was bizarre, to say the least.
For sure.
It's kind of funny that you mentioned Roberto Duran and No Mas because I couldn't let you go without talking to you about that. So yes, that was November 25th, 1980 at, I believe, the Louisiana Superdome. And this would have been the rematch between the great Sugar Ray Leonard and the great Roberto Duran. It's a shame that No Mas is probably the thing that Duran, for all of his championships and all of his accolades and his legacy, will probably be most remembered for. What were your thoughts leading up to the fight, and what was the atmosphere like after Duran waved the fight off?
Well, I remember going in, I thought Duran was going to win again. And in retrospect, that wasn't a very wise pick because, you know, the proximity of the rematch to the first fight was very close. And Leonard mentally was there and Duran mentally wasn't there. And, you know, Ray Leonard, say what you want about him. I think he was largely misunderstood by a lot of boxing fans as a golden boy, maybe a media creation, all that stuff. It's ridiculous. You know, he's the greatest fighter I ever covered. I can still say that to this day. A master at being Sugar Ray Leonard, you know, a master at being able to control his image and behave in a way that, you know, increased his appeal. And, you know, that fight is kind of what made him. That and Hearns combined, and then Hagler, of course, later.
Yep.
Ray Leonard was very lucky in that he had tremendous foils to compete against during his prime. And did he fight who he wanted, when he wanted, for how much money he wanted, where he wanted? Yes. But that's when you're number one. That's the advantage you have. And any fighter would be foolish not to take advantage of it. So he's the best there ever was. But after the Duran Nomas, utter shock. And then my memory serves, it's a long time ago, but what I remember most is the next day, there was a press conference. Don King was there, you know, whoever was there. And Ray Arcel, the trainer of Duran at the time, who was probably already in his 80s, just looked like he was a wonderful man. Someone I got to know well. I got to know his wife well as well. Wonderful man. And he was just heartbroken. And it was on his face. And he knew this was the end for him because of his age. And he couldn't go back to working with Duran after what Duran had done. But it was so, I mean, think of how shocking it was for the media and the boxing fans what Duran had done. It was even more shocking for him. And I just remember his face and his sadness at what had just happened. And he was inconsolable.
Wow.
Yeah. Roberto Duran was an absolute monster. I mean, I think of when he knocked out Ken Buchanan. He just couldn't be stopped, you know? And even the first fight with Leonard, you know, you hinted at it in your response. He'd gotten inside Leonard's head, insulted right. his wife, as I'm sure you know, and, you know, did all these things and made Leonard fight his fight. It was a brawl. Yeah, as far as Leonard being a media creation, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, he, gold medalist, Benitez, Hearns, Hagler, you know, his greatness to me is indisputable. Yeah, it goes on and on. And across, what is it, five divisions? Something ridiculous.
Amazing fighter. And just to get back to Duran very quickly,
yes, sir.
Another
Absolutely.
Image I never forgot was, I often get asked, what's the best fight I ever attended? Well, I wasn't lucky enough to be at Hagler Hearns, and I wasn't lucky enough to be at Corrales Castillo, but I was at Prior Arguello 1. And I think Barry gives the same answer. That was the best fight ever. And what I remember, not only about how great a fight it was, but as we were getting up to go to the press conference, post-fight press conference, Duran walks in the ring and fights, I think it was Jimmy Batten, I don't remember exactly who, but he fights the walkout bout with the stadium empty. And to look at Duran in that situation, which is an insult for a fighter of his ability and his background and his resume.
Absolutely.
To see him in that situation, you said, he's done, man. He's yesterday.
And yeah.
Of course, we know that he went on to beat Iron Barkley, Davey Moore, et cetera, and win more titles and become a great fighter again. So it's, his story is, you know, ups and downs and ups and downs that make it absolutely remarkable.
Absolutely. And fought until he was 50 and only quit because of a motorcycle accident.
Right. He'd still be going now, I think.
Probably. Yes, Barry did give me the same answer, curiously enough. I watched some of the highlights of that fight yesterday, and I forgot. They just do not stop throwing punches. It's incredible.
Yeah, and the stakes were hugely high because Arguello was trying to become the first fighter in history to win titles in four divisions. And the atmosphere was amazing. This was during a lot of unrest in Nicaragua. And
Arguello,
unfortunately, was plucked right in, you know, out of the middle of all that. So there was, you know, when the fireworks went off before the fight, Arguello actually recoiled because he thought, you know, God forbid that this assassins or killers in the audience. I mean, that's the kind of atmosphere it was, very tense. And, you know, the Orange Bowl was filled up, and it was just a great fight. Two great all-time great fighters and a fantastic finish, which a great fight needs.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, funny enough, Barry did give me that similar answer there. He said that, yeah, because of, I think it was Arguello's political views. They had the Sandinista, the FSLN, I think it was called.
The Somoza backers. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Barry told me that, you know, all the lights were sort of dim in the stadium. And I guess a lot of people didn't know that they were going to be shooting fireworks off. And
right.
the spotlight's only on him. He's the only person in the whole stadium lit up, and he thinks that there are gunshots going on. He's like, yeah, that definitely made me a little tense.
That's funny that Barry's memory is the same as mine there, which is a good thing because we're both getting up there in years. So we don't want to think our memories are failing us.
Well, since we're there with Prior Arguello, what were your thoughts on the controversy? Let me back up. What were your thoughts on the Panama Lewis issue? Prior's trainer, of course, grabbing water that he mixed and giving it to Prior.
Well, I think that we know a lot more subsequent to that event than we did at the time.
Right.
Panama Lewis was a very charismatic guy, but until the removing the padding from the gloves at Madison Square Garden, Lewis Resto, we didn't really know what he was capable of. But once we saw that, we brought back to Miami, to Prior Uruguay, and we realized this is a guy who could do anything and would do anything to win. So did that affect the fight? Possibly. But, you know, don't ruin a good story with the facts. It was such a great fight. And people don't even really, you know, remember that or talk about it. And we don't know what the effect was on Prior, if he was given peppermint schnapps or what it was. But ultimately, he still had to fight his butt off. And he did. And he got the win. And I don't take anything away from him.
Absolutely. I often think about the Billy Collins, Louis Resto fight. Not only, by the way, Panama Lewis, not only did he take out padding from Resto's gloves, which would have been enough, but he also put plaster of Paris onto the wraps. So, I mean, poor Collins, literally, you watch the fight and the fact he's literally being hit basically with cement.
Yeah.
I'll tell you the same thing I told Barry. In my view, Resto and Lewis should be tried for conspiracy to commit murder.
Yeah.
I really believe that.
Yeah. Well, they both went to jail, but not for that long.
Not for that long. And Pama did pretty well. I don't know if you saw that documentary, Assault in the Ring.
Sure.
Yeah. Lewis did pretty fine relative to Resto.
Yeah. He couldn't get licensed to work a corner, but he still trained fighters.
Right. Right. No, thank you, Steve. Sorry, I trailed off a little bit there. Get me started on boxing and we'll be here all day.
I know. Well, there's a lot to talk about. It's fun stuff.
Sure is. I do want to talk about The Ring magazine.
Yes.
Yeah. Huge boxing magazine, obviously referred to rightfully so as the Bible of boxing. Talking to non-boxing fans for a second, it's a huge deal in the boxing world. The Ring has its own championship belt, which is viewed more highly than any of the alphabet belts. So I'm curious how you came to be the editor-in-chief of Ring magazine and what were your day-to-day responsibilities there?
Well, I became editor in 97. The magazine at the time was in big trouble financially, struggling tremendously. Nigel Collins had been the editor. There were months where they didn't print it. They were based in New York. And the owner, what the owners were Dave DeBuscher, the famous basketball player. And he had a partner in Chicago. I think his name was Nick Clattis. And they wanted to sell. And everybody, the word on the street and the word in the business was that they were going to sell to Dr. Jerry Buss, the owner of the Los Angeles Lakers, Showtime. And it was a given. Jerry Buss loved boxing. Matter of fact, Jerry Buss probably lost more money promoting boxing at the Forum than he made with the Lakers and the LA Kings. Anyway, it was assumed Buss would buy the magazine. Well, my boss, Stanley Weston, and his assistant, Ken Gaditis, sort of slipped in between the cracks, spoke to DeBuscher, and boom, like in a day, bought the magazine. And it was a shock to all of us because we all thought Buss was going to get it. And we at the time, I was the editor-in-chief of KO Magazine at the time, which we were very proud of because we went toe-to-toe with The Ring, pun intended.
Yeah.
And I got called into Stanley's office and said, well, we'd like you to be the editor. Would you want to be? I said, of course. And that was 1997. And I did it till, that was 1989. And I did it till 97. So about 8-9 years.
Wow. Awesome. So then, yeah, what were your day-to-day responsibilities like? Were you assigning stories, articles, et cetera? Or I'd love to know kind of what your daily was like.
Yeah, we had a staff of about four writers. Bobby Cassidy, who you may know the name.
Yeah.
He was a very famous fighter. Joe Tintel, Ed Maloney. We had Jeff Ryan, who was an outstanding writer. For KO Magazine, most of the writing was done in-house by the staff. For Ring, we assigned a lot of freelance pieces. And my day-to-day operation was to plan the magazine, edit the magazine, do some writing. And keep in mind, this was a factory that was putting out at the time three or four monthly wrestling magazines, in addition to KO Magazine, in addition to World Boxing Magazine. So we had a deadline basically once a week.
Wow.
So it was almost like we were on deadline all the time, almost like a daily, you know, even though we were monthly magazines. So it was a lot of work, tremendously satisfying. And, you know, we brought, I say we, because I was only a small part of it, we brought The Ring back, you know, to a place of prominence. And when I left in 97, Nigel Collins took over as editor-in-chief and did a great job. And I think it even elevated it more. So I'm glad to say it's still around today and it's over 100 years old.
Yeah. Started by the great Nat Fleischer.
Yeah.
So I've always been kind of curious. The question is going to be a little bit jumbled because I'm not sure of it myself. But isn't it that Golden Boy bought The Ring some time ago?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And they own it now. Yeah. They bought it from
Kappa.
From Kappa, which was based in Pennsylvania. So for me, when the company moved from Long Island to Pennsylvania, I cut a deal with my boss where I would be there 2-3 days a week and, you know, Ambler, Pennsylvania, and work the rest of the time from home. So for a few years, it was in Ambler as part of Kappa, and then which continued to put out the wrestling magazines as well. And then Golden Boy bought it, which was controversial because obviously having a promoter, you know, being the publisher of the number one boxing magazine. But Doug Fisher does a great job as editor. If there's any editorial interruption or influence given by Golden Boy, I don't see it. So I think I'm glad the magazine is still there, and I think it's in pretty good hands.
Yeah, excellent. Obviously, The Ring, you know, when you join there, The Ring has this incredible legacy. As I mentioned, Nat Fleischer, the pound-for-pound ratings, The Ring belt, etc. Might be an odd question, but did you ever get intimidated by the responsibility?
I'll tell you, the first time I realized that I was, you know, playing with history is I would go down to the basement of the office and doing research, looking for, you know, looking at files, clip files, and I would see notes all the time from written by Nat Fleischer. And I realized these notes were written in 1926, 1932, whatever. You know, he was the editor and the owner for about 50 years.
Yeah.
It was intimidating. You know, I was still pretty young. And I realized, like, this is boxing history right here. And then next to the files, there would be a room with memorabilia that unfortunately got pilfered by each publisher and editor and owner over the years, and less was around. But there were priceless items of boxing memorabilia there. And a combination of the clip files with the Fleischer notes and everything and the boxing memorabilia, it was intimidating. It was like, this is, you have a serious role here that you have to maintain to keep the reputation of this magazine as it had been.
Yeah. Yeah. No question. To give our listeners maybe just a quick sense of the influence The Ring and Nat Fleischer had, my favorite story to tell, and I bet you'll know the second I start. The second Ali Liston fight, the referee, Jersey Joe Walcott, is called over by somebody when Liston is knocked down, and that person is Nat Fleischer. And if I remember correctly, I think Fleischer is telling referee Walcott that it's a long count and it's a knockout. And what's one of my favorite stories, because I just think about someone being so influential that he can literally pull a referee, you know, mid-fight, mid-count, as a matter of fact, right, to, you know, to tell him that. It's one of my favorite boxing stories.
Yeah, Nat Fleischer was it. He was everything. He was as big as it was. And you have to remember, too, that in the Ring's heyday, if you want to call it the 40s, the 50s, boxing was a much bigger sport. You know, it was a major sport. The old saying was, if you walked into a bar in New York City to talk sports, people were talking baseball or boxing. Mm. You know, the NBA was really minor in those days. The NFL hadn't exploded yet because television wasn't there. You know, horse racing was a much bigger sport too, but the biggest two sports were boxing and baseball, and that's what people talked about. And unfortunately, you know, with time, boxing has become somewhat more marginalized, and it's more of a niche sport now than it used to be. It's still a great sport. Not going away, but it's not what it was. And some of that fault is boxing, you know, hurting itself all the time, shooting itself in the foot repeatedly, and not having the structure that other sports have.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and, you know, in fairness, the 40s and the 50s, we have Sugar Ray Robinson, we have Louis Marciano, Basilio, right, Fulmer. I mean, I think Benny Leonard was fighting in those days. Just an absolute who's who of boxing. It was definitely a heyday for boxing as well as The Ring.
Yeah, it was. And one thing people forget, who call the 50s the golden age of boxing. Yes, you had all those great fighters. The sport was a major sport. It was also run by the mob.
Yes.
And that wasn't so good. Nope. So, you know, who
Mr.
was
Gray.
Champion, who wasn't champion, you know, was determined by, you know, Mr. Carbo and all the gangsters that ran boxing. So that wasn't so good either. And fortunately, that's not the case anymore.
Yeah, for sure. Agreed. So with The Ring magazine, one thing I've always been curious about, I'd always await my issue back when I was boxing, and the first thing I'd always go to would be the pound-for-pound ratings.
Right.
Yeah. So I'd love to know if you could describe the process for deciding the pound-for-pound ratings, and also perhaps you could tell our non-boxing audience what exactly a pound-for-pound rating is and why it's important to boxing nerds like us.
Well, pound-for-pound ratings, which I believe we started in KO magazine in the 80s. So it was in KO before it was in The Ring. Pound for pound ratings are a mythical determination of how two fighters or all the fighters would do if they were all theoretically the same weight and they fought each other. So if you took a bantamweight at 118 pounds and you put him in with the heavyweight champion, you know, who has the better resume? Who's done more? Who would you rate higher? So it's totally subjective. It's not based on anything other than opinion. But because of the influx of champions and titles in boxing, which is, of course, ridiculous. And fans needed a second set of ratings to determine who was legitimate and who was the best and who wasn't, because the regular ratings, well, you were champion of one organization, I was champion of another, this guy was champion of another. It was very confusing for the fans. So pound for pound gave them a little bit of understanding of how good is this guy? Well, this is how he compares to other champions. And, you know, now being pound for pound champion, whoever that is, whether you consider it, you know, Inoue from Japan or Usyk or whoever, Mayweather for many years, of course, it's important. It's important to the sport because it gives fans a little bit of a clearer picture of what's really going on.
Yeah, it got really bad, I think, in the 90s in the heavyweights, because I think there was something like 20 separate heavyweight champions. I mean, well, yeah, it is funny. But I'm thinking, you know, if I can't keep up, then there's, you know, no way a casual fan can keep up. I mean, you have the NABF, IBF, IBC, IBA, right. You know, I can go on, but I'll give myself dyslexia, right? But yeah, no, excellent. Yeah, The Ring magazine, man. Oh, one of my dreams was to write a piece for The Ring. Never happened.
So you still can.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I suppose. Maybe I might be kicking out an email to The Ring at some point.
Hey, when I was editor, I got a letter in the mail from California from a guy named Doug Fisher. And he said, I have a piece on Shane Mosley I'd like to write. Maybe you don't know who Shane is, but he's a big star out here in L.A. I said, send it. He sent it. We printed it. And now he's the editor of the magazine. Many, many years later. So go for it.
Hey, you know what? I think they'll be hearing from me.
There you go.
What was your most memorable interviewing experience?
Well, I have to think for a minute. I remember the only time I was physically threatened, where I really felt I was in danger. I'm not going to tell you the name of the fighter because he's still with us. Okay. But I went to Philadelphia to interview somebody and I was late. The Amtrak train was late. I'm never late. I'm obsessed with being on time. This time I was late. Well, we go into the room of his promoter to do the interview and he shuts the lights off. It was really black. And he says, you know, I'm shutting these lights off. I could do anything to you right now and nobody would know the difference. And I said, well, what the hell have I gotten into? And he was a big guy. He was a light heavyweight. I'm not naming names, but he was a light heavyweight. This is a long time ago. Fortunately, he calmed down and I was safe. But I guess he was trying to make a point. But that was a memorable interview. Also, on a whole different level. Jesus. Doing Showbox, which of course is live television, we had a prospect that we showed again and again named Antoine Douglas. He was, I want to say, 140-pounder. Anyway, we had him on, and his mother was sitting in the first row, facing the cameras, and screaming. And, you know, there weren't that many people. This was Showbox. This wasn't some huge fight. You could hear everything she was screaming on TV. So the producer says in my ear, go interview her in between rounds. Maybe, you know, at least we'll explain to the viewers who she is. Can't remember her name. Mrs. Douglas. I can't remember her first name, but it's on YouTube, I believe. And if you go to it and you watch it, it's only about a minute long, but it's one of the wildest interviews. Basically, I almost proposed to her, or she almost proposed to me on live TV, and I'm married already. But it was, she was screaming and screaming for her son, and it's pretty funny. So check it out on YouTube.
Excellent. That's great. So Steve, as you look back on your career, and maybe this is the same answer as the last one you gave, but let me go ahead and ask it regardless. Is there one particular moment that stands out for you for whatever reason that made you angry, happy?
Well, plenty of all of those, I guess. Oh. mostly happy and mostly, you know, gratifying. For me personally, a couple of things stand out. One was fascinating, which was when I testified at the RICO trial against the IBF. I actually testified in court for 11 hours, and I worked extensively with the FBI and the New Jersey the people who were prosecuting him. And it was a fascinating experience. And what I remember most about it is that it was about 9:30 in the morning. I'm in Newark testifying with the criminal lawyer questioning me. And I'm talking about payoffs to Colombian managers of flyweights. And it's not exactly the most exciting thing in the world. And I take a look at the jury, you know, the 11 people there, and three of them are fast asleep. And I said, I guess this isn't the most exciting thing in the world, but I did my job. So that was a fascinating experience. And then probably the most gratifying was getting inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame, which happened in 2017. And that was just, you know, validation for a long career spent in one industry. A great weekend. Canastota is a great place. And if any of your fans, I don't know if you've been there, Joshua, but if you haven't been, you have to go to Canastota during induction weekend. It is a fantastic experience.
Excellent. Yeah. To my shame, I have not yet. I do plan to.
You'll love it.
Yeah. No, I have no doubt. You know what? I'm really glad you brought it up because I squandered the opportunity to ask Barry, but I'll ask you now. what is the experience of being inducted like? Do you know, what's that whole process?
Well, it was, you know, Barry and I were lucky enough to be inducted the same year. So that was great. My partner, you know, on TV. But it was a different experience for us because I had been to the Hall of Fame previous induction years several times in support of Al Bernstein, in support of, you know, just to go as a media member. So I knew exactly what the experience was going to be like in general, where it was new for Barry. But the best way to describe it is of the 20,000 or so people that are there during the course of induction weekend, every one of them is a hardcore boxing fan. Now, you can go to fights and talk to the people ringside, the fans ringside who bought tickets. They're not all boxing fans. But you go to Canastota, and every one of them knows everything you need to know about boxing and more. And the fighters, to their credit, and this is, you know, different than other sports, the fighters are very engaging, very accessible to the fans. And that's why it's called boxing heaven for ex-fighters. They love it. They love being recognized. They love being appreciated. So they have interaction with the fans. And you put all that together in this small town of 5,000 people. And it's just, there's nothing like it. It's just, it's, I hope to go again one day, but it's a unique experience. And to be inducted, I never signed so many autographs in my life. Some of the people I don't think knew who I was, but they wanted my autograph anyway.
No, that's great. No, thank you, Steve. Just a couple questions left, Steve. So I'm often thinking about, you know, who my favorite fighter is of the moment. And if you're anything like me, that answer changes fairly frequently. As it stands now, I think my favorite fighter, just in terms of pure accomplishment and in terms of mastery of craft and in terms of just doing things that human beings shouldn't be able to do, not Floyd Mayweather Jr., oddly enough, but Bernard Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if you have a favorite fighter. Well, I suppose you already mentioned it, didn't you? Sugar Ray Leonard.
Leonard, I would rate as the best fighter. Duran is probably my favorite fighter. And of today's fighters, if I had to pick one, boy, it's tough. But I'll tell you the guy that, you know, I'm going to always lean towards somebody that we exposed on Showbox, you know, for the first time.
Sure.
So for me right now, it's probably Boots Ennis, who I don't know if he's as good as he's looked, but if he's half as good as he's looked to date, we're talking about a potential all-time great. Now, he hasn't won a title yet because he hasn't had the opportunity, but he's just an absolutely fantastic fighter. And we were fortunate enough to have him on Showbox and has continued on Showtime. So I've been exposed to him a lot, but he would be, that's the first name that comes to mind in terms of just pure potential. And he might already be the best welterweight in the world.
Yeah, no, excellent, Steve. So what are you working on currently, Steve? You're still doing Showbox, I believe, yeah?
Still doing Showbox, still doing a lot of work for this Showtime Championship Boxing Show, research, editing, and of course, unofficial scoring, which is fun to do. I get ripped on Twitter like crazy after every show, no matter how I score. But that comes with the turf. So the scoring, yeah, and I still work on Showbox. So it stays busy because between Showbox and Showtime Championship Boxing and pay-per-view, there are probably 20-something shows a year, and they all take a lot of work. So I'm happy to still be doing it. I'm not doing any on-camera work anymore because of my health issues, but
yes, sir.
I miss that. But, you know, I'm glad to still be part of it. Showtime has been great to me. I will be very loyal to them forever. And, you know, that's the way it goes. It's been fantastic working for them.
Oh, that's great. Well, this was a blast, Steve. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time for me. Bit of a boxing dream come true to be chatting with you for a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for saying that. And it's been a pure pleasure.
Oh, thank you, sir. Last question. Steve Farhood, how can people find out about you?
I am on Twitter. If I weren't in boxing, I wouldn't be on Twitter. But I am on Twitter. It's at Steve Farhood on Twitter. I'm also on Facebook, but I rarely go there. So the best way is through Twitter.
Awesome. Steve, thank you so much again for the time. I really appreciate you taking it for me.
Thank you, Joshua. I appreciate it. And I hope you write an article for The Ring magazine.
Oh, thank you. I will get right on that. I promise.
Great.
Take care, Steve.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth. as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.